My name is Ricky Day, and this is Nothing to Lose But Yourself. What's going on, everybody? I hope you are having an amazing day. Once again, my name is Ricky Day, and this is Nothing to Lose But Yourself, the podcast where we endeavor to change the world one conversation at a time. Listen, if you haven't done it already, please tell your friends, spread it in your network, and ask them to subscribe wherever they listen to podcasts. I'm really excited about this episode today. In this episode today, we are going to talk to one of America's greatest faith leaders and theologians, the Reverend Michael A. Walron Jr., a.k.a. Pastor Mike. He's a senior pastor of First Corinthian Baptist Church in Harlem, New York. And today, Pastor Mike and I chat about his upbringing on Roosevelt, Long Island, the role of faith and spirituality in America today, what it means to be human, and most importantly, we talk about the role of Jesus' teachings in helping us to see ourselves through God's gaze and our own gaze, as opposed to the gaze of empire or the oppressors, which of course then makes it easier for us to develop, to embrace, and to love our authentic selves. This conversation will challenge what you believe and why you believe it, but it will also help you to liberate your mind, to invigorate your soul, and to treat each other with more kindness, humility, and love. So, without further ado, why don't you sit back, relax, enjoy your commute to work, your evening glass of wine, your morning cup of joe, whenever you're listening, wherever you're listening. I am just grateful that you're taking us with you. Enjoy this conversation with the Reverend Michael A. Walron Jr., a.k.a. Pastor Mike. So my guest today is, as I shared, an amazing person, one of America's greatest theologians, and definitely one of America's greatest and most dynamic preachers and pastors, the Reverend Michael A. Walron Jr. He's a graduate of Morehouse College and, of course, Duke University Divinity School. He's a husband, he's a father, and I'm blessed enough to say that he's a friend. Without further ado, let's dive into this conversation with Pastor Mike. What's going on, Pastor Mike? How are you?
Great, man. How are you?
I'm good. Quite the start to 2021. How's the year treating you so far?
2021 has been okay so far. I mean, other than the obvious insanity, it's been good. It's been good.
How about those Jets, by the way?
Wow. Okay. How we starting out?
Nah.
I've decided that at the end of this season, I'm taking a 2-year break from the Jets.
Just 2 years?
Only 2 years. I'm a diehard. I've stuck with the Jets through thick and thin. But this year, it wasn't even losing. It was the fact that the head coach still has a job that I'm confused by. And so I can't have that added agony to my life. And so I'm going to take 2 years. I'm not saying, I don't know if I'm going to root for another team yet. I'm just going to be just a general football fan. I want to get a team. I don't know. I don't want to get on the, like, I don't want to be on the bandwagon of the team that's already good. I want to get a team that's kind of trying to make it, you know. Because the Jets, I just can't do it.
Well, I mean, you can stay in the same stadium and switch teams if you want. You got your Giants.
Yeah, I can't do that. My spirit won't let me do that.
So let's dive in, man. So, you know, as you know, obviously, I'm enrolled in the certificate program at New York Theological Seminary. And one of the more empowering experiences of my life, man, so far has been to unpack like all the embedded theology I've been carrying around all my life and engage in some deliberative theology. And it occurred to me in the midst of it that so many people, myself included, attend church for 15, 20 years and don't really even understand just the basic tenets and concepts of Christianity. So what I really wanted to do at the beginning here is just real briefly, just give people a little bit of a brief definition of a couple of key terms so that people get a sense of where we're going in this conversation. And it gives people some context, because I think that's going to bring value to people, especially a lot of the millennials that are listening to this. So, you know, one of the first terms, of course, we come across is exegesis. You want to describe to people what exegesis is, what it means?
Exegesis is, I mean, just basically it means to critically examine text, in particular scripture, but any text. You can exegete any book, any text, but it's often used when it comes to critically examining scripture in particular.
And the next term, I think, is theology. People hear theology, but I think a lot of people don't really understand what it is.
I mean, the etymology means a study of God, right? But that's not possible. But most people, what it really probably speaks to is talk of what people believe or assume God to be. Right. It's not necessarily studying God, but it's more unpacking who individuals believe God to be.
And to that end, there's a couple of theologies. There's embedded theology, and then there's like deliberative theology. So just kind of unpack that for folks.
Embedded theology is kind of, like you alluded to earlier, it's the theology that we receive, that we live with. Maybe we received it when we were young. Sunday school, you go on and on. It's based on a set of assumptions, agreed upon meanings that formulates the foundation for how we think about God. It's not that we went to study it. It is how it has been handed to us. Deliberative theology is more of an intentional move to, I would say, investigate those things we've assumed, to do a deeper dive into the things that we've assumed theologically, those theological presuppositions that have shaped how we see the world and how we understand God, how we understand ourselves in relation to God. Deliberative theology is more of a deeper dive into how we have arrived at those places, and to see whether or not what we call embedded theology or the embedded theology we've lived with has any value.
Right. Yeah, because that's been one of the interesting pieces of it for me. You know, there's this embedded theology I was walking with, but then as I started to learn and to study and to form some of my own ideas about it based on the things that I'd learned in school, I realized I don't know that I agree with some of this stuff that I learned before. And obviously, you know, when you talk about exegeting text, that if you don't do that well, or you don't do that in a particular kind of way, you can start to form a theology that doesn't necessarily serve you well.
Yeah, I mean, there are layers, I think, to what you just said, in the sense of, you know, you get, in your case, you're in school and you begin to analyze the embedded theology, right? You look at it and say, I wonder if I really do believe this, if these assumptions do speak to my belief system. Where I'm at in my journey now is the next phase, which is I'm actually critiquing the stuff I learned in school and not critiquing it through the lens of embedded theology, critiquing it for its institutional flaws that have shaped the theological paradigm of Christianity.
Yeah, that's important. And so to that end, man, I don't want to assume all the people listening know who you are and know a lot about you. I've read that little brief intro at the beginning, but tell people a little bit about your journey, where you're from and how you answered that call to ministry all those years ago.
Man, I don't know about the call story. That's forever. But I'm the first one in my family born in the United States, either side, mother, father side. Both my parents are from Barbados or Barbados, as you say with a little accent. And we came here, my family came here first to Brooklyn and then to Long Island. My grandfather purchased a house in a town called Roosevelt, and it became kind of the house where many of the people from my family who migrated to the States stayed at. So at one time as a child, I was like the only child in a house of like 10, 11 adults. I don't remember, it was a lot. People come over from Barbados and stay at the house and be two and three in a room and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And Roosevelt is an interesting town. It's one square mile. It's a small town, but it's a town that is packed with so much history, from entertainment to sports. One of our greatest sports icons, of course, is Dr. J. Calvin Mackey. I think played football Hall of Fame, was from Roosevelt as well. But Dr. J. Entertainment, you got, you know, Eddie Murphy and Public Enemy is out of Roosevelt. And so many other people, but it was a small town. When the time I came up, it was all black. It used to be all white, but you know how that went. When white flight took place and black folks started coming from the city into Long Island. Roosevelt was one of those towns that you got onto, came to quickly on the Southern State Parkway. Interesting story about how Robert Moses, who designed much of the highways in New York, he designed the overpasses on the Long Island parkways to be low so that public buses could not get on the highway, which they thought would hinder the amount of black folk who could get out to Long Island. Mm-hmm. But what they didn't anticipate was the day when black folk would get cars and come out to Long Island. And so by the time I came of age in Roosevelt, it was all black. The only white people I saw in Roosevelt were some teachers, interestingly enough. I had a lot of white teachers in elementary school, but I had a black principal in elementary school. So I saw black leadership, and I saw white people following black leadership as a young child. And Roosevelt is a tough town. I mean, people think of Long Island, they think of, you know, these beautiful lawns and trees, and there were lawns and trees, but my town, anyone who knows about Long Island, Roosevelt was not that image. I tell people, Roosevelt High School was like the school from Lean on Me. You know what I mean? Like, it was really like that. It was bad. And people talk about, you know, Harlem or the Bronx or Brooklyn, and everybody has their stories about whose hood is tough. But what I will say is that Roosevelt is the only school district in the entire state of New York that the state had to take over. It was so bad. So the state had to literally come and take over the school district because it was bad.
It was literally the only school district of the state that they had to come take over.
Maybe one recently, but as I know, it's been the only school district in the state of New York that the state had to come take over the whole district.
That's a major statement.
Yeah, it got that bad. I mean, so that's the environment I came in. I came up, and in the late 70s, 80s, you know, it was options. You sold drugs, you played sports for the most part, you tried to stay out of trouble, or you also did a combination of all, like I did in some ways, and became a 5 percenter. I was a 5 percenter all through high school. And it was tough, but you know, you learn how to navigate it, you know, and you learn how to navigate because you learn how to fight. Yeah. You learn how to deal with that. So, you know, I can say a whole lot about Roosevelt, but at the same time, it was an amazing space. It is a space that really shaped me and formed me. My greatest lessons in life came on the streets of that town.
Now, you don't get out of those kind of spaces and achieve the things that you achieve without some intervention, without some mentorship. Tell me about what that journey was like for you.
Well, there were people, too. I always found myself being drawn to older men, like my grandfather, my godfather. I lived with my grandfather. Like I said, we all lived in the house. And my godfather lived next door. And I loved spending time with them. Whether I was an old soul or not, but I loved spending time with them. They poured a lot into me. It was from my grandfather, I think, gave me my greatest life's lessons about what it meant to be a decent human being. As a young man, I didn't always adhere or understand it, but as I got older, I understood what he was doing. It was from my godfather that I think I learned fighting, because he used to be a Golden Gloves champ. And he taught me how to, you know, punch and snap a jab. But he also taught me about jazz. He helped me. He's the one who really fueled my love for jazz. He would always listen to jazz and explain to different artists to me. So I would be like 8 years old sitting in his living room, and he'd be sitting there with his Johnny Walker, you know, sipping. And we would listen to Billie Holiday, and he would explain to me the artists. And it was just an amazing. I didn't understand how the profound impact, but it did. Those two men really profoundly impacted me as a man. As now that I look back on my life, I think of who I am as a man, what shaped me as a man, those two gentlemen did. mentors. There was a mentor who really saved my life by the name of Greg Groover. Mm-hmm. My grandfather by name was Edwin Waldron. My godfather was John Williams. Greg Groover was a mentor who I was in a program called Operation Alternative. It's kind of designed to help get kids out of off the street. Sometimes those people who were in trouble, you had to go to this program. You went to this, what's called Operation Alternative, right? Mm-hmm. And he was the first one when I was at my worst, probably as a teenager, saw past it and saw my possibility and my potential. He would always tell me, to this day, he still tells me, the very first time I met him and sat in session with him, he was telling me all this stuff about, you try to play this role and, but I see a leader in you all of a sudden. I said, look, bro, you need to shut up because I'm going to shoot you if you keep talking. And I threatened to kill him right that day, right? And he still to this day, we talk every now and again, he remember, the first time we talked, you threatened to kill me. Right? And I mean, it was crazy, but he literally is the one who got me to even take the SAT, who got me to even consider college, and who ultimately got me in the Morehouse. He was a Morehouse grad, which I did not know at the time. And was good friends with the director of admissions. I mean, I'm skipping a lot, but that's how I ended up getting to Morehouse, because of one person who really poured into me, started making me believe in what I could be, and showed me how to get out of that environment I was in. Yeah. And Morehouse became a way out. Atlanta became a way out of the environment I was in.
That's amazing. And, that love of jazz that you got, plus your love of hip hop that I know that we share, it's interesting because it infuses your preaching style.
Absolutely.
You freestyle, yeah. You come off the dome. Tell us a little bit about how that style kind of evolved.
I mean, I think most people, preachers in ministry, especially if you come into ministry, you see pastors, write these sermons. And when you go to seminary, they talk about constructing sermons. And I did that for a long time. During my first pastor, the first church I served for a few years. And it just all felt unnatural to me. I felt it was difficult for me to just sit there and commit to a script. And there were times I would read it, but I would often go off script and come back script, go off script. And then one time I was preaching as a guest preacher at a church. And at that time, I would make these little notes, paper. So you had to be small and when everybody knows, I was having these big pieces of paper. I couldn't stand seeing preachers turn these big pieces of paper. So I would get little notepad paper and write all these notes. And so one day I was preaching at church and I always had my notes in my Bible. I have one of a smaller size Bible. But I want to be big time this Sunday, right? Because they had the big, big, giant Bible in the pulpit desk. And I left my Bible in the chair. It was time for me to walk up to the pulpit to preach. So I just walked up with my notes, put them down on top of the Bible. And I don't know what provoked me to... But when I put them down, as I pray, introduction, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I went to find the scripture that was in the gospel. The Bible was like on a psalm. And I was going to preach, I think, from like the gospels. So I turned it, not really, I turned the page over on my notes. So now I read the scripture, realizing, man, my notes are in this Bible somewhere. So I'm praying. While I'm praying, I'm actually trying to find the notes while I'm praying. So it's like the longest prayer in history, right? I couldn't find the notes as I'm flipping the page frantically. I had to just preach. And that was a moment that showed me, I could preach the sermon without the notes. I had read it. I wrote it. And, of course, as soon as I finished the sermon, I was able to find the notes right there. Right. So that started me minimizing my manuscript, putting more points down and preaching. It wasn't until probably about 18 years ago or so where I stopped doing notes. No, let me be correct. It was about 15 years ago. I stopped preaching notes, period, and I stopped writing sermons. So I haven't written a sermon in about 15 years or so. And so for me, the preaching moment is a creative moment. So I literally believe in improvisation. So preaching is an improvisational, it's a spiritual word, highly spiritual, but it's also an improvisational, artistic word. So that moment in the pulpit is when I'm constructing the sermon. Many people don't believe me, haven't believed me, because there's such a methodology, but that's always in my head. The methodological approach to the sermon, the constructing of it is always in. Now, filling in is different, but I don't write sermons. I don't prepare sermons. I don't memorize. that moment in the pulpit is a construction of the sermon. I build it in the pulpit in that moment.
Yeah, I got to admit, man, I didn't believe it either until I've seen it. And, you know, being your friend and being around and watching it come together, it's amazing. But it makes sense. I mean, it's art form as much as any other art form is. If you've done the work, you know, you know your verses, you know what you need to do. It makes complete sense that you can do it. You know, and that's a good time to pivot to talking about faith in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this conversation about the secularization of America. And in many ways, it feels like it right now. You know, so many Americans, young and old alike, are turning away from the church and religion in general at a time that I think we need faith probably more than ever. But they don't necessarily lack for wanting something spiritual. It's just not coming from the church. I know we've had some conversations about that. What do you think is kind of fueling that? And how does a place like FCBC, which is actually growing in the midst of that movement, how did that come together? And what are your thoughts?
Well, I did an interview for a piece for CBS last week, and he raised that term secularization. It's not a phrase or term that I use at all. For me, everything is sacred. That doesn't mean everything is religious.
Right.
When people talk of secularization, it's often over against that which is sacred, right? And so for me, everything is sacred. All of creation is sacred. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons that church is losing so many people and young people is because let's just give the facts. 46%, that number may be higher now, 46% of millennials make no claim of religious affiliation, though they are spiritual, as you alluded to. And the reasons they say why they're not in church, in particular in Protestant and Christianity, is because of the rigidity, the lack of tolerance. Many young people, millennials, have grown up in a very tolerant world. You and I did not grow up in a very tolerant world, right? And many of the people who lead these churches are Gen Xers, right? And unfortunately, many of us have the baggage from the previous generation, which was not tolerant, which is very rigid. And I think people are turned off by that. They're turned off by the empty rituals. They're turned off by the ceremonies that are devoid of meaning in some ways. And there is meaning to some of them, but they question the relevancy of the meaning and how it applies to one's lived experience. And then I think theologically, Christian theology needs a true reformation. I think that theology right now is lacking. And that is not to say God is lacking, because one of the problems that people make theological reflection synonymous with God reflection, right? And I think theology is lacking. I think Christian language is lacking. I think it needs to evolve and it needs to reimagine itself. And Martin Luther ushered in the Protestant Reformation. It was not a reformation of theology. It was a reformation of practice. So we're still living with the same conceptual ideas that are, you know, centuries old, a millennia old. And we have to ask ourselves, does this still speak to our current times? The problem is that many people are afraid to question the relevancy issue because they think that the question of relevancy issue somehow minimizes the integrity of the faith. Right. It does not. It doesn't minimize the integrity of the faith. In fact, it might actually strengthen the integrity of the faith if we begin to look at it and examine the language, the terminology, the beliefs, the doctrine, all of that. Now, people may hear me say that and say, oh, my God, that's heresy. But I question all those things in a particular way, because as I look at Christian doctrine and unpack Christian doctrine and really critique theological assumptions steeped in tradition, I do it through the lens of Jesus's teaching and the teachings of the carpenter and the ways of Jesus, not just using Jesus' name as a tagline onto my created belief system.
Right.
Right. An idea of belief system itself is problematic. When you're in seminary and you hear about systematic theology, there's no systematic theology that shapes the universe. These are neat ways for us to feel that we have some capacity to manage that which is inexplicable and mysterious. We use these words, these concepts, these ideas to give ourselves a sense of ease in the face of ambiguity, right? Mm-hmm. But language itself is problematic. If more Christians understood language, and I don't mean is their syntax correct, if more Christians understood that language is always symbolic, and the signifier. Language itself symbolizes the thing at which it's getting. If I see right now, if you and I are walking outside and we see a tree, right? Mm-hmm. And I say, Ricky, look at that tree. You say, okay, yeah, that tree is cool. Okay. What we have just done is agreed, right, on a linguistic relationship, right, without question. We both agree that what we've identified in reality is a tree, but our capacity to identify it doesn't get at what it is. Saying it is a tree does not get at, as a philosopher say, does not get to its tree-ness or the essence of what it is. You and I just agreed upon a language and agreed upon a definition, and then we both say tree. I had an interesting moment, spiritual moment, some years ago on the trip. I was driving through rural Virginia during one of my 40-day sabbaticals, and I felt like I had like a moment. I went into trance. I'd been praying and meditating, and I felt like I had a conversation with a tree, because in this field was this massive oak tree. Mm-hmm. And I promise you, I feel like I was in a trance. And in the trance, I had a conversation with the tree. And I said, tree, you know, how old are you? The tree said nothing. I said, tree, tell me what you've seen, because I'm sure you're old. Tree said nothing. Tree, what does it feel like being a tree? Tree said nothing. And it was silence for I don't know how long. All of a sudden, I heard a voice say, what's a tree?
Wow.
Right? So here I was addressing this thing, expecting conversation with a false assumption about identity. That's what language really does. It's an agreed upon set of meanings that you and I agree upon. For example, do you speak Portuguese?
No.
Okay, watch this. I don't either. If you and I, then again, we go to Brazil where they speak Portuguese, and we were in a restaurant where nobody's speaking English. What are they speaking? Portuguese. And we're probably a little baffled, confused. Well, let's talk about what's happening. What we're actually doing in that restaurant is listening to grunts and sounds. Mm-hmm. Not language.
Utterances, yeah.
It's utterances. It's sounds. The only reason why you and I are communicating, because we've agreed upon the sound, the meaning of the sounds we make. If we're in a system where we don't know the meaning attached to the sounds, it's just making noise. It's just literally vibrations from the air flowing from your body through your vocal cords. Mm-hmm. That's all it is, vibrations. We just agree upon the nature of the vibrations you and I are making right now. Well, think about now Christianity. We put these absolute definitions with limited language, right, that never gets to the essence of God, of faith, of spirituality, and then we will fight for it, die for it. Imagine, we're dying for stuff that's not real, for words that really don't get to the heart of what we want to communicate.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I found one of the other challenges for me is the hypocrisy that tends to rear its head, because, you know, people talk about being Christians. And for mm-hmm. me, my understanding, that means to be a disciple of Christ, to follow his teachings, to live as Christ lived. And it doesn't seem to be that we approach that, let alone achieve that. You know, and I'd be interested in you sharing with people what, you know, your definition of discipleship is, and how we're falling short of that, particularly as American Christians, particularly.
Well, part of the problem is that Christianity is deeply invested in maintaining the institution of Christianity. That's the first problem. Christianity as an institution is more in line with maintaining certain power relationships than it is getting in some way to the heart of who people are. When you inject the language of disciple, you know, I think of the Great Commission from Jesus. Go ye therefore and make disciples. Now, he doesn't say go build cathedrals, create a new system based on me, indoctrinate people according to these beliefs that are disconnected from who I am and what my teachings are. He doesn't make disciples. How? He gives two directives. Baptize, he says, and teach what I taught. So discipleship is not about joining a church. Discipleship is not being on the roll. Discipleship means you've made a decision in Christ, for me, to follow the teachings of the carpenter, which means that the teachings are the foundation. Doesn't mean the rest of the Bible is irrelevant, of course. Mm-hmm. But the teachings of Jesus are the foundation. where I critique Christianity is that I'm not convinced that Christianity in general, as we understand it in this country, in the West in particular, sees itself as being an institution grounded on the teaching of the carpenter.
I would agree with you. I mean, just look at how Christianity has acted out over the centuries, not even just recent years, over the centuries. It doesn't mm-hmm. feel Christ-like at all, a great percentage of the time. And in the mm-hmm. contemporary setting, it absolutely seems actually diametrically opposed to the teachings of Christ and the way it moves absolutely. Sometimes.
Well, there's the other thing. You know, I'm always going to push you. Mm-hmm. There's the other thing. I don't use the word Christ. Ah. Because Christ is a title.
It's a title.
It's not a name. And so Jesus is the person. But see, many people gravitate. Jacqueline Grant wrote a book years ago called White Woman's Christ, Black Woman's Jesus, the womanist text. Mm-hmm. She made a great observation, though. When you go in most, I went to a predominantly white school for divinity school, Duke. And many of the white people I encountered, Christ, that was the language. In many hymns, old hymns, Anglo-Saxon hymns were in Christ. On the slave plantation, they said, Jesus.
Jesus.
You know, when we sing in church, there's not a friend like the lowly Jesus. We don't say there's not a friend like the lowly Christ, because Christ is not lowly. Christ is an exalted title. It is why, to me, I put it in a nutshell. Christianity has built an institution around the idea of the Messiah, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. Discipleship is a way of being focused around the carpenter and his teachings. That's it.
That is profound. And that is a significant difference. I think I'm glad you pointed that out, because people do forget that Christ is indeed a title and Jesus is actually the man that was here. You know, you did this, you preached this sermon very recently about being resilient in the face of absurdity. And it's causing quite the stir. I'm getting text messages and all kinds of communication about it. Positive. But people are just, people are enraptured by the fact that somebody who they know is committed to Jesus, who is a theologian, who is passionate about love and about God, is actually speaking truth to power. First of all, the fact that people are so surprised that that's happening is a problem in and of itself for me. But secondly, it really was amazing. And I want to talk for a little bit about some of the issues and themes that you covered in that sermon, because I think they absolutely speak to who we are right now as a country, as a people, and in this world. So one of the things you talked about first was humankind's inability to handle the mystery of life and the effects that inability has on, you know, the formation of identity and how we relate to God. And let's unpack that a little bit.
First, let me say that I watched the service. You know, we record it and I watch it on Sundays. And it's always painful for me at times to watch sermons. But now I've learned how to objectively watch myself. Mm-hmm. My wife will tell you, Sunday, I watched the sermon listening as someone who needed to hear a word, detached myself from it. And I cried. I was moved by the sermon. I cried as a person, first, because it moved me. Secondly, because I felt like my preaching actually reflects my theological beliefs.
Absolutely.
Versus preachers who preach what works. Okay? Because there are certain ways you can preach and get by on what works. You preach for response. You say certain hook lines. You do things to get a reaction. Mm-hmm. For me, I'm not really concerned about it. I'm not concerned about people running and screaming and shouting. I'm not concerned. I'm concerned as with whether or not what I proclaim is authentic to who I am and is a direct reflection of what I actually believe versus what I've been told to hold on to. So that's first. Secondly, human beings have a hard time not knowing. That's why I started the sermon on Sunday. Mm-hmm. We have to have an answer. Having to have an answer is part of the arrogance of some of our humanity. We feel that as human beings, if we don't have answers, it's synonymous with being weak. So we don't see it as an opportunity to discover, to be curious, to investigate. We see not knowing as being synonymous with weakness versus having the opportunity to pursue and learn and evolve and grow. We want to have a set of assumptions and believe that those assumptions are absolute and we carry them to the day we die versus saying we evolve and grow. and we learn things.
Right.
So the reason why we have a hard, and I'm saying we have a hard time with God, is because if we say things like God is, I had this conversation with my wife the other night. You know, you hear in church, Ricky, people say, oh, preachers will say, you know, he's the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And then they'll also say that God is infinite. Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Right.
If God is infinite, that means there is no beginning in it. So which is it? Do you believe God is infinite, or you're saying what sounds good and works? Because I can't say Alpha and Omega if I know God is infinite.
Absolutely.
Doesn't make sense. There's no starting point. There's no ending point. Right? So that's part of the thing. I want to make sure, and even how I teach, I press people to see if what you're telling me is what you really believe. Mm-hmm. And if you don't really believe what you're telling me, let's dig deeper to find out what it is you really believe. And there's nothing wrong with that process. You're not less of a Christian. You're not less saved. I don't use that language either, but yeah. So, but I think we just hate not knowing. And in the place, you know, here's what I read one time. Dietrich Bonhoeffer called it God of the gaps, where we do not understand and where we don't have an answer. We just say it's God, and that settles us.
Right.
Yeah.
You also in that sermon describe God as creator and not controller, which I thought was profound, because that's one of those things that I don't think people really think about. We, and so many people subscribe to this, you know, predestined kind of life that we live, and God's controlling everything and his hands all over it. But you really refuted that and in a profound way for me. Let's unpack what you meant by that. You know, what does that mean for humankind? The fact that God is a creator and not the controller, and talk about, you know, the humankind's role in creation.
Yeah, I mean, the text from Sunday with Genesis 2, 19 and 20, and it was when God had created, said every living thing on land and air, and brought them before Adam and told Adam to name. When we introduce, now, first of all, let me back up. The scriptures are, especially the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, are the Hebrew, Jewish people's account of how they came into existence. It is not human history. It is a history of the Jewish people's understanding of how they came into existence.
Right.
And the introduction that they give us to this God is God as creator, not God as savior, not God as redeemer, not God as healer, not God as miracle worker, God as creator. And the creator God then invites Adam to now name what the creator has created. That doesn't sound like a egomaniac. That doesn't sound like an insecure God. That doesn't sound like a God who has to be in control. It sounds like a God is willing to share in that moment of creativity with one of God's creations, which is human beings. I make it, Adam, you name it, right? The problem with us is because the truth is we don't want to be honest about our fears. We don't want to be honest that we're fearful of failing. We're fearful of making mistakes. We don't want to make decisions because we're fearful of consequences.
Absolutely.
And so we want to put everything with God. So we want God to micromanage our lives. We want God to control everything. So at the end of the day, we can blame God, but that's not even what happens. At the worst, we blame, well, at best, we blame God. At worst, we blame ourselves. We internalize when things go wrong. And then say, well, God must have been upset with me because God didn't do this. On Sunday, for the sermon talk back that I do on Sundays after the sermon, mm-hmm. I was talking about this, and someone talked about, you know, well, at the end of the day, God is going to intervene. I said, intervene? I said, why? I said, what does that even mean? Well, doesn't God intervene in things? I said, I'm not sure. Now, when you say that as a pastor, immensely, some real hardcore Christians would be like, oh, you're crazy. God intervene. Well, hold on. Don't think about you who need a new job and you get it, or you went to the mailbox and there was a check when you needed money and couldn't pay bills, that intervention. I'm talking about the child that's being molested by a stepfather or uncle who was molested all the way from 7 to 14, has had trauma unreconciled, deep wounds, deep damage, has affected them in ways that are almost unrepairable. And here's the question, why didn't God intervene and stop that? See, the way we think of God intervening makes God very random. Because mm-hmm. then the question then becomes, what is the criteria for God's intervention? And what do I need to do for God to intervene? You see how it turns on yourself? Because now if God doesn't intervene, what happened? I did something wrong. Rather than thinking your idea about God is flawed, your thoughts about God are flawed, and your expectations of God may be problematic based on your flawed assumptions, right? So that's what I meant. We want God to control everything versus living in relationship with the God who invites us to be co-creators. The philosopher I spoke to, the writer I spoke about, Albert Camus, said basically, it is our freedom that scares the hell out of us. Absolutely. And we are so fearful of our freedom, we create institutions and structures that keep us bound. Because we are more at calm in chains than we are with wings.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we're afraid of our own freedom because we're afraid of the responsibility of our choices.
Yeah. And here's the thing. If God is who we say God is in our language in Christianity, right? Faith isn't about making the right choice. Faith is about believing God is with you. So what are bad choices? What are mistakes? What are consequences if God is who we believe God to be? Right? Mm-hmm. Because God is going to confirm, validate, or redeem, according to our belief. But see, Christianity speaks out of both sides of its mouth. And most Christians speak out of both sides of their mouth. We say, you better behave or God's going to punish you. And then the other side, we say, well, grace is real.
But, you know, that's because I think we, A, are just repeating the things that we've heard. And B,
embedded theology.
And we're not comfortable with not knowing. So instead of saying, I don't know, I don't understand, we want to invent the thing that we understand or believe that we don't necessarily really believe.
Make it real, Ricky. And COVID, look at all the craziness you heard about COVID.
Yeah.
God is mad with the world. Oh, God is punishing. You had preachers saying that. And some of the same preachers said that died from COVID. So now what does that mean for you?
Yeah.
What is your congregation supposed to think? If you said that this is God's punishment on a sinful world and you die from COVID, well, what does that mean? And what happens to the people who listened and believed you? And what are they now to think? I guess pastor was living a sinful life we didn't know about. I mean, it's insane. It's insane.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. And it's just tragic that it's forced on so many people and people willingly accept it. And then, you know, you're left with more questions than answers. You're uncomfortable with not having the answers. And it can lead to a type of insanity that, you know, we're walking around here with. Yeah. And you start to attack other people as a result.
Look, I'll add this one piece though, Ricky, because you said I talk a lot anyway. But
you're a pastor. You can't help it. It's your trade.
Yeah. You know, there are people who critiqued me some years ago for a statement I made from the pulpit. It went viral. It was a 55-second clip. What was deep about it is that I didn't care. But it was very revealing what the criticisms were. And the clip that people were talking about. The clip, it was two parts. I said, it is insane to tell someone they're going to hell for not believing in Jesus. Well, by the time the articles got written, this is what it said. Mega church pastor says it's insane to believe that Jesus is the only way.
Yeah.
What?
I remember that well. And I was there. I remember that well. Yeah.
And then the other part I said in it, which was baffling to me. That's where the only way comes. I said, I celebrate all paths to God. Can you imagine? People who claim to be Christian, upset with a pastor who said, I celebrate all paths to God. Now, nobody, of all the articles that were written, nobody called me one time to have a conversation. In this age, we just run with it. There were clergy members who stopped inviting me to their church, who when I was scheduled to come preach, canceled the engagement.
Wow.
Not because they actually talked to me, but because they believed in the clickbait. Right? And mm-hmm. These are people, Ricky, who I had been preaching in their churches for years with no issue. But now one thing happened, all of a sudden, you know, he done gone crazy.
Have you had conversations to them subsequent to that?
Oh, no. No. I try to eliminate shallow people from my existence.
Okay, there's an argument for that. There's an argument for that.
Yeah, I'm, you know, that's me being facetious, but no, I
know.
I haven't.
what do you think when you think about these things in these terms, what do you see is the role of the faith community in helping people with the formation of their identity? You know, this podcast at the foundation, it's that I think people really need to get a sense of who they are authentically as their self, and not only get a sense of who that is, but to embrace that and to love that self. Because if you understand, in my theory, if you understand enough about who you are and embrace and love your authentic self, it makes it much more difficult for you to seek to oppress or look down on other people. You're connected to creation in a really organic sort of way. And so I'm just curious, what do you think is faith's role in helping people with that formation of their identity?
Well, for me, when you say faith's role, I think of what I believe is at the heart of Jesus's teaching. I teach, and I'm writing right now, a book whose working title right now is The Way of the Carpenter. And I think primarily Jesus comes to help us do three things that I think is the role of, as you say, faith. He comes to help us reimagine ourselves, reimagine God, and reimagine who we are in relationship to God. Now, reimagining the self gets to the heart of what you say, what you talk about, like authenticity, because you have to remember Jesus's audience. Jesus is speaking to oppressed Jews who are living under Roman occupation and are shaped by imperialism.
And all the mental health concerns that go with that.
And everything that comes with that. Being an oppressed people in an imperialist regime.
Sounds familiar.
And so he's trying to help them see themselves. Watch this, and this is going to sound very bad. Not under the gaze of empire, but under the gaze of God. Mm. And to liberate their minds and their eyes so that they don't define themselves over and against empire, right?
That's profound. I want to sit in that for a minute. That's profound because in the art world, we talk about, you know, black bodies and how they've been portrayed throughout history. And first of all, we're invisible for much of art history. But then when we are portrayed quite often, it's through the white gaze, which is a very specific kind of way of looking at us as opposed to the ways in which we can look at ourselves. It's really profound to hear you talk about through God's gaze as opposed to the empire's gaze.
But when I say God's gaze, I simultaneously say our gaze as well. Mm-hmm. But the problem is I have to say God's gaze because our eyes have not been liberated.
Right.
Right. To see ourselves authentically, because we're always looking at ourselves over and against that which has power over. Not always, but many of us. So Jesus is helping them see themselves. I know how you feel. I know what Rome is doing. I know how Rome defines us. But we are God's children. And now he says God is Father. Now, this is not about patriarchy. It's not whether or not God is a man, because I don't believe that. God is spirit. But when Jesus says God is Father, what he does that becomes so offensive is not the idea of Father. It is that Jesus speaks about God in intimate language in terms of relationship. Now, I personally believe he speaks of God is Father for him, if we believe the story. It says more about the fractured relationship growing up in a household of father you know that is not your father. I mean, that's a different conversation.
Right.
That's making Jesus a human being with real life issues, right, of identity. But I think help for faith is being able to see ourselves through the lens of God, see ourselves free to shape and give meaning to our lives, to be true to who we are, and not allow ourselves to be defined by people whose expectations seek to undermine our humanity. And then that's what Jesus is seeking to do. That's what the faith should do. At its best, being a disciple ought to help you have and create a creative encounter with God and yourself in such a way you come to a new estimation of your own self, right? And not of yourself enslaved to this idea of God, but like Genesis 2 showed, but a human being who's in partnership with God in the creative process and living that authentic life unfiltered by foolishness, unfiltered by other people's biases and prejudices. And that's, I think, what faith ought to do. And faith ought not say, well, this is who you ought to be.
Right.
Right. Jesus becomes a companion on that journey of self-discovery.
And in that self-discovery, you can move through that with confidence and at the same time with humility.
With humility, you know. One of the freest human beings that we both know of, not know personally. I mean, there's many free human beings who walk this earth. Mm-hmm. I say this because of the conversation. One of the freest human beings that we know was James Baldwin.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah.
James Baldwin was free to write the way he wrote in that time, to be as vocal and say the things he said. He refused to be defined. And most importantly, he refused to be defined by white people. Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, his profound question, I've used his question he raised in so many formats, you know, who's the nigger?
Right.
You know, and asking white people if who you are is if who you think I am is a reflection of how you see yourself, then who's the nigger? And if you made me the nigger, you have to ask yourself why you needed the nigger in the first place.
Exactly. And that's a profound question. And
absolutely.
And the thing I think people forget about that and about Baldwin in general, not only is that a profound question, but it's a very loving question.
Because it is trying to get even in that context, the oppressor, to see the inhumanity of the oppressor's ways and to get the oppressor to actually see what is at the heart of the oppressive structures, which is rabid insecurity.
Absolutely.
Low self-esteem. So flip that now. If you need to send me to hell because you don't like me or you think I'm different, what is it about you that needs to send me to hell? Right?
What is it about you that needs to oppress us? What is it about you that can walk past a homeless person? What is it about all of those things?
Yeah.
That's profound. You know, and I think Baldwin is clearly a hero, but also Howard Thurman. Spoke on the same types of things in so many ways. And you actually, one of the people that introduced me to Howard Thurman in a much deeper way. Let's talk about Howard Thurman and those related teachings that.
Well, what you have to know is that Howard Thurman was criticized by many, many African-American clergy and many clergy in general, because he did not capitulate, I mean, to much of standard Christian doctrine. Right. He was very much overtaken by the spirit of the carpenter. And he was about helping people actualize their full potential in spite of the contradictions we face in life. His teachings on Jesus, his main teaching is in the book Jesus and the Disinherited. But his teachings on Jesus, I mean, one of them I share with you, is trying to understand the radical nature and the amazing courage of the carpenter to teach the way he did in that time.
And in that context.
The context to be among and see, let me make it real. Let me make it real so people understand what Jesus did and what Thurman talked about and all these Christians. If I right now was invited to have dinner with Donald Trump and went to his house and sat and had dinner, I would be called all sorts of names, including sellout, Uncle Tom. Now, go back to Jesus' time. He went to the home of a centurion soldier. He sat in the house of a tax collector. Two men who were hated and despised.
Despised by the community.
And he refused to be defined by those narratives because he believed, I'm convinced, in the transcendent power of love. Love. Right. When you think of the fact that when Jesus tells a story and he makes in one story the hero, a Samaritan, who are despised as a subhuman people. In another story, he glorifies the role of women, right? I mean, you on and on. We think we want to follow Jesus until following Jesus leads us to the dinner table with Donald Trump.
Yeah,
and that's where you got to get it real. Don't talk in these theories. Talk real. He's hated by most. And let me be clear, I have no fondness of Donald Trump. I pray that God doesn't ask me to sit down to dinner with him. Right?
Right.
But that's what Jesus did. He went and sat at the table of enemies.
And at great now, and at great peril from both sides. Because going to sit with those enemies could end it very wrong for him with the enemies. But then you think about the disciples who are outside waiting, like, what is he doing? Is he selling us out?
That's what Thurman was saying. That to be in that moment to see Jesus' actions had to be confusing for some. You know, it's like when the disciples came back and saw him talking to the woman at the well. And were like, what are you doing? Well, to understand that scene, most Christians will read the story and bypass it and get to the part, you know, come see a man who told me all about me. Well, you have to know in Jesus' day, Jacob's well was a place where prostitutes were picked up. So when they see Jesus at the well talking to a woman, they think, wait a minute. You know, is this like a necessary distraction in the ministry?
Right. Like, what's up with you, Jesus?
And then the story. How is it that you, she says, a Jew is engaging with me, a Samaritan? Because they had two different views of religion. And with how you worship God. For the Jews, God is worshiping in the temple. For the Samaritan, God is worshiping on the mountain. And Jesus said there's going to come a time where God is worshiped neither in the temple nor on this mountain, but they that worship God will worship in spirit and in truth. My God,
yes.
Do you know what that meant to say that? You just said that what we believe as a people, that God is in the temple, is wrong. People miss the radical nature of Jesus. And that's what I try to teach and recapture. So if imagine this, Ricky, if I follow this Jesus, if I believe in this Jesus, then I'm not worried when people get angry at my teachings or mad at what I say or no longer want or disinvite me. You don't teach this way. You don't become a disciple with the expectation that everywhere you walk, the doors will be open. That's why Jesus told the disciples, where they welcome you, you be gracious. But if they don't, shake them like dust off your feet and keep it moving.
Absolutely. You know, it's not an easy walk to be a Christian, not a true Christian. No, a true follower of Christian, a true follower of Jesus, disciple.
Yeah,
of Jesus.
It's easy to be a Christian.
Yeah, it's easy to be a Christian.
It's hard to be a disciple.
Yeah, because it's a thankless situation. Like you can only do that out of love.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You can only do it out of love. You know, what do you say? And I hear this often. Because as you know, I'm a man of faith, but you know, I connect with young people, as do you. And quite often I'll hear from people, well, yeah, I mean, I love God, but I can't be a Christian. I can't deal with the church because that's the masters. That's the white man's religion. They're asking me to kiss my enemy who's trying to kill me. You know, what do you say to people who speak that way?
You know, I hear people say, you know, Christianity is a white man's religion. Well, actually, it's not. And I don't have to go in depth on it. Let me just give this analogy.
Yeah.
A poor practitioner of the faith does not define the faith. Christianity preceded Americans using it as a tool of oppression. It is older. Christianity is older than the institution of slavery. It is older than the concept of whiteness or race itself, which is a construct. And it precedes all of that. Because there are white people who used it as a tool of oppression does not mean they controlled the definition of it and the terms of it, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm amazed when people say, here's an analogy you gave. Oh, I can't do church because, you know, hypocrites. I can't do church because they... Well, here's a deep thing. I've been to some bad restaurants. Exactly. Food was terrible. We live in New York. We had some bad food. You didn't swear off restaurants. You found a good restaurant to go to. Mm-hmm. So when I hear people say, I can't do church because of X, Y, Z. Well, you've allowed that experience and those people to define the faith for you. or I can't go to church because when I was in this church, they did X, Y, Z. There are more churches than that church. Christianity is not a white man's religion. Jesus was not a white man. And the institution constructed as a tool of oppression is a construct for oppression. And white people have used it masterfully. But the faith itself is not, does not belong to a race of people. So no more than Islam is a black man's religion.
Right.
You know, so that's not true.
You know, and when you think about all those kinds of conversations that people have had and theology, bad theology that people have lived under, people, many people have been wounded by church and run away from it forever, if for a long time, if not forever, myself being one of them. But in this, you know, this age of millennials who are spiritual, but not necessarily into church.
But not religious.
And not religious.
S-P-N-R. That's a whole thing now. Spiritual, but not religious.
Exactly. But in the midst of that, in the context of that, FCBC, First Corinthians mm-hmm. Baptist Church up here in Harlem, where your senior pastor is growing and thriving and feeding people and having people really reimagine their relationship with God and with themselves. Talk to me about how you have created FCBC to be the kind of loving, affirming and space that it is and a place that really grooms people for discipleship.
Yeah. When I started FCBC, I asked leadership what were their targets. And people looked at me like I was speaking another language. I said, who are you trying to bring to church? And who know who, you know, is that whosoever will? And I was like, no. I said, that's not true. I said, because next door to church, a Chinese restaurant, and they're not targeting people who want to buy Whoppers. They're targeting people who want chicken lo mein or shrimp fried rice. So you have a target. Then they have, I said, well, here's a target that God laid on my heart. It was the unchurched that everybody claims to be going after, right? Secondly, those who grew up in church, like myself, yourself, we just got tired of it when they got old. It was whack, it was terrible, it was boring. And then third, those who were damaged by church that you know you talk about. And what do you do? I didn't stand in the corner saying, hey, if you've been hurt by church, come to FCBC. If you got tired when you got to be a teenager, but now no. You create an environment that's saturated in love and acceptance and affirmation. You begin to really speak to people in a way that's not trying to lift up these doctrines, you know, but really speak to people's everyday lived experience. That's what Jesus did. I read a book about someone who I respect a lot. And in a book about preaching, he said, you know, if you're talking about, you know, how people ought to cope with life and anxiety and giving lessons for how people ought to live their everyday experience, he said, that's public speaking, but that's not preaching. I said, what? So when I read the book, I put the margin. I said, so what was Jesus doing? When you say when somebody knocks at your door at midnight, you give them bread. What is that about? Is that esoteric conversation about theological doctrine or is practical living? When you said celebrate and rejoice when somebody loses a sheep and they find it and we rejoice together, what is that? Doctrine or practical living? Right. So Jesus actually talks about how we live in human relationships and how we interact together and how we get along together. And again, he's talking to who? Oppressed people, because you know what happens, because oppressed people under imperialistic regimes don't necessarily feel empowered to fight against the system. They fight one another.
Right.
And so he's talking about how do we live together? How do we honor one another's humanity? And so I wanted to do that. I've been doing that. Create the environment where we do those things, where we honor the inherent dignity of everyone's humanity, where we seek to lead and love, where we seek to honor the teachings of Jesus. That's not about indoctrinating people to some kind of set of beliefs and saying this makes you a Christian, but saying that our faith is lived out with how we treat one another. This is Jesus. How we feed the hungry and clothe the naked and give water to those who are thirsty and visit those who are sick and visit those who are in prison. How when we see need, we treat the people's needs as holy and respond to the needs of the community. We don't sit to judge and seek to look down our noses as though we're better than others because our shared humanity is on a status of equality. I mean, you create that environment, you preach these sermons, you teach that way, and then you demystify church. You look, I don't like preaching in robes, I don't do it, right? I don't like preaching in suits necessarily, and I do when I have to, but I don't do it. You demystify church, you make it more acceptable and reasonable. You create a space where people feel comfortable being themselves and coming as they are. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want people, as my friends said, when I was a little boy, invited them to church when I was like 9, they didn't come. They told me they didn't have church clothes. So I show up in a shirt and jeans. I show up in a sweater, and I show up that way, and I create an environment where everybody feels cool and comfortable being themselves. So you create a culture, because if we're going to change the culture, you have to use your language and plus your actions, your practice. Language plus practice changes the culture.
Right.
So my language is consistent with the carpenter. The practices are consistent with the carpenter, and the culture is consistent. That's why people from all walks of life find their way in the FCBC.
Yeah, I mean, we worship next to Jews and Muslims and all kinds of folks on a regular basis. I think also people forget that people's first encounter with a congregation or a Christian community or church is through you as a human being and your actions and your life, how you're carrying yourself, how you're interacting with people. And I think that's one of the disconnects so many people have had over the years. You know, they're looking at people be one way in church, and then they're being backstabbing, two-faced, and gossiping outside of the walls of that church. But I've noticed so many people. Now, FCBC is not perfect. People aren't perfect. But, you know, we all kind of move through the world in a particular kind of way. And so people get a sense of who we are and what's going on in there by the way we show up in the world. I mean, so many people ask me about church and, A, why am I in church and so active again? Because they didn't think I'd ever be again. But B, like, man, how do you move the way you move? Like, this person's crazy, but you interact with them and you're there for them. I'm like, it's who I am as a disciple of Christ, and it's who I am as a member of a faith community that really moves through the world as a disciple. Last couple of things before I let you go. You know, we have this identity statement that we say every time we convene service. Where did that come? Well, let's people know what it is. And where did that come from? And I think, honestly, it should be the identity statement of the United States of America and everything.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think about that sometimes for all faith communities. I really do. When I first thought about that, would you just say, is that arrogant? But no, I was like, this speaks to who we're called to be. So, you know, and I've only made one additional these, but we are an ever-evolving community of visionaries, dreamers, and doers who've been called by God to live the lives we were created to live, commanded by God to love beyond the limits of our prejudices, and commissioned by God to serve, called to live, commanded to love, commissioned to serve. That came to me now in 2009. I was sitting at my desk at home, and literally I was reading a book. And while I was reading a book, I had a notepad, and it was a book by Erwin McManus. And I'm reading the book, and I paused, and I literally wrote that down in one writing.
Wow.
I wrote it down, except for the doers part. That was added a couple years after. And I wrote it down, and I was like, we are every evolving community of visionaries, dreamers, and doers. Called by God. That quick. It must have been like 3-4 minutes, literally. No correction. I came and I introduced it to the church. And it has been our statement. And everything is about what God does. But the idea of living the life you're created to live, one, that speaks to what your podcast is about, authenticity.
Yeah, authenticity.
Loving beyond the limits of our prejudices.
Which is easier to do when you're comfortable and love your authentic self.
There you go. And that's the work of the carpenter, to transcend the boundaries that we use to divide us. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately understand your work is to serve creation. So live, love, serve. But live, love, serve. See, when you hear people these like sayings, you know, live, love, laugh, live, love, serve is what comes out of the statement.
Right.
So that live, love, serve is within a context of a larger framing that I think speaks to all people who believe in God. And the reason why some people feel comfortable at FCBC, they don't hear some of my samples. Oh, you know, Allah ain't God. You know, Buddha ain't God. Right. Krishna ain't God. Shiva ain't God. Well, I am a technical Christian. And here's my language for me. Say, I'm a Christian who takes the teachings of Jesus seriously. And I am a disciple of the teachings of the carpenter. But I also, as you see, have Buddhist prayer beads on, mala beads. I practice certain aspects of Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, right? But at the center, I'm shaped by the carpenter. And these other things that I've incorporated, do they make me less of a believer? No, They've actually expanded my humanity. Mm. And that's what we're, our life's goal. Like, I'll give you an example, and I'll say this. A rose, at all points, is always seeking to be the best rose it can be. Mm-hmm. A coconut tree is always trying to be the coconut tree. A lion is always seeking to be a lion. But human beings, we don't always seek to be the best human beings we can be. And that's why the journey is evolving, ever evolving, because we're always striving to expand our humanity and grow in who we are. And when we do that, something profound happens within us. And whatever is the guiding framework that does that for you, doesn't shrink you or cause you to shrink other people, that is your life path. That is the path you are. For me, it's the teachings of the carpenter.
And you know, I had something else I wanted to ask you, but that, that, my friend, that is the end. I know when to shut up, and that would be now. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. And I continue to pray for you and blessings to you and your wife, Reverend Dr. Lakeisha Warren, who's an amazing theologian and president of New York Theological Seminary herself. We're going to
Madam President,
we're going to have her on, my Leo sister. We're going to have her on soon as well. But thank you for your time today.
Let me say this. Are we recording still?
Yeah, we are.
Ricky, I want to say thank you for having me on this podcast. You're my brother, my friend. But, you know, as you blow up in life, have me back on, because, you know, don't just one off me, you know, bring me back down the road, you know, to share just something. You know, I'm just saying, I know, you know, it's going to blow up. Just have me come back.
Now, you know, you almost had me call you stuff that I call you probably. That starts with an N. You act like we are not going to continue our journey together with me producing your amazing show, The Journey with Pastor Mike.
Well, we're going to do some other things too.
Yeah.
That's the nature of life. Again, it's always evolving. Everything is seasonal, but everything is always growing.
Absolutely.
And I think that's it.
That's amazing. And I just wanted to publicly thank you for, you know, being an amazing pastor and now a friend. And my mother thanks you, too, because she still can't believe I belong to a church. I go to church every week, let alone I'm friends with my pastor. Not that I was a bad young man, but, you know, just church.
Tell her to pray for me, Lord.
But no, all jokes aside, you being so faithful to God and just being a good human being has really kind of inspired me and some other people to lean into our gifts and to trust God with our lives and to be who we were created to be. And I've said a big yes recently to doing some things. So I'll be continuing my studies, it looks like, at New York Theological Seminary. Someday I might be Reverend Dr. Ricky Day. We'll see.
Hey, let God continue to unfold everything as God has been doing. As the universe has been showing up and revealing, continue to walk in the revelation.
Absolutely.
And that's the beauty of this journey.
So let's leave our guests with, what do you want people to know as they navigate these times that we're in? What's the thought that you want to leave people with to get through these next few months and possibly years?
They're not my words. These are Howard Thurman's words. Mm-hmm. It's one line. The contradictions of life are not final.
The contradictions of life are not final. Great words from a great man, the late Howard Thurman. And a great conversation today with another great man, Reverend Michael A. Warren Jr., a.k.a. Pastor Mike, of First Corinthian Baptist Church in Harlem. If you want to follow Pastor Mike on social media, his Instagram and Twitter are Mike Walron, WALROND. And if you want to listen to some sermons or otherwise engage, it's FCBCNYC.org. What a great time we had catching up today and speaking about faith and God and what it means to be human. I hope that you all get what you need to get out of the conversation and that you don't allow others to frame the way you see yourself or the way that you see God or the way we see each other. Do the work to liberate your mind and connect to God, to the universe, to Jesus, to self, and to each other in ways that are loving, life-giving, and authentic. I don't have to know you for what I'm about to say to be true. I love you. I do. And I suspect you want to love me too. And you want to love each other. I mean, life is too short. And there's so much life to live. Who's got time for pain and stress and strife and division? Get on with the task of living. Lean into living and be grateful for living. I hope you have an amazing week. And again, I want to leave you with this. Know that you are enough. That you are not alone. And you are loved. I'm Ricky Day, and this is Nothing to Lose But Yourself.